Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome here to the Mark Steiner Show and to Soundbites. You listen to Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, in Baltimore, Maryland, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, heard throughout the Delmarva Peninsula. And I want to remind you on our way to our conversation that you listen to Soundbites each week, but we want to hear from you on how we can bring a healthier food to our communities and our families. I'd like you to be part of some larger discussions taking place this week about our communities, about our city, about our region, about our world. You can join us for two town hall meetings. One is tonight, Tuesday night at 7 p.m. We'll have an interfaith discussion about how to teach about good food from that perspective, featuring the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, R.A. Witkin, and Dr. Jeanette Hablula. It'll take place at the Mount Pleasant Hope Baptist Church at 430 East Belvedere Avenue, 7 p.m. Please come and join us for that conversation. It's going to be stimulating and great. And then on Thursday at 7, we're at the Central Branch of the Enoch Pratt Library for a lively discussion about how our food is being taken over by industrial agriculture and how we can reclaim it. We'll be talking with Christopher Leonard, who wrote the book The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. And you, that's this Thursday night at 7, you can call 443-804-1252 for more information, or just show up. Join us at Enoch Pratt on Thursday down on Cathedral Street at the main branch, or at Heber Brown's Church at Pleasant Hope Baptist Church tonight, 430 East Belvedere Avenue. There's a Belvedere in New York. For this interfaith discussion. And now we're about to talk to Baksar Sunkara, who is the founding editor of Jacobin, a publication offering socialist perspectives on politics, economics, and culture. Baksar, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Very happy to be here. Thanks so much.
And we're looking forward to talking about Soylent, but let me let you hear this for a moment before we talk about what this Soylent really is.
What is the secret of Soylent Green?
New York City, in the year 2022. Nothing runs anymore. Nothing works. But the people are the same. And the people will do anything to get what they need.
This is the police!
What they need most is Soylent Green.
The supply of Soylent Green has been exhausted. Return to your home!
And that was a movie in 1973 talking about the year 2021, not long from now, when Soylent will become the food because the earth is being destroyed, breaking inward both economically and in terms of the environment. But Soylent is not a dream. It's real. Baksar, when I saw your article, I remembered this movie as a kid. But we're there.
Right. Actually, I think this movie was really based on a lot of fears that people had in this particular moment in the 70s about overpopulation and just the state of our cities and whatnot. I think a lot of those fears have kind of abated. But I did actually like the tongue-in-cheek name that Robert Reinhart, the creator of Soylent, this powdered meal replacement, gave his product. Because I hear that marketers and investors, everyone has tried to convince him to change this, but he thinks it's just a hilarious name. So I very much respect his lack of business savvy.
Well, talk to us about what this is. I mean, this is being touted as something to replace food, right? What we are cooking, our cooking our meals and harvesting our food. So talk about a bit what this really is.
So essentially, it's just a powdered meal replacement. It contains 35 essential nutrients in one tiny pouch. You mix it with water and then an oil blend that helps with consistency and also has fish oil and like omega-3s. Apparently, there's also a vegan version available. It's really part of a trend that's existed for decades. We've had plenty of meal replacements. The only difference is this is a little bit more complete than something like Ensure. It's closer to the amount of nutrients that we have in medical grade things that they give to patients that can't consume solid food. The real new thing about Soylent and just the marketing and branding around it. So this set, these biochemists around Robert Reinhart, I really have the what I call the hyper optimism of the TED set. You know, they really think that this is something you could live on for all eternity, and this is something that they themselves consume 70-80% of their meals. And yeah, it's really, really been very divisive. And in a sense, what I set out to do was kind of to defend it from the socialist left. And it was very difficult to do that because most people rightly are very skeptical about something that could take away their lunch breaks. One of the few nice reprieves that we have in capitalist society.
So why do you like this idea? Do you really like this idea?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's an interesting thought experiment about the relationship between technology and politics. So historically, workers have always resisted change. We realize that it's not in our self-interest. Technological change has increased the pace of production, and it's also made many forms of employment redundant. We've been replaced, living labor, human beings have been replaced by dead labor, and in many ways, machines. And in many ways, it is true that technological change has made life for ordinary workers often much harder when it should make it easier. So for me, something like Soylent could be absolutely dystopian in societies that exist now, but we could easily imagine a society in which it has many implications. For example, even ending cooking as we know it is itself, I think, a victory against the sexual division of labor in the household. It's an environmental victory. So obviously, Soylent is still food material. It still requires resource extraction, but it would not require anywhere near the amount that we spend on traditional agricultural production, which is something like 70% of our fresh water. The way we consume livestock is 20% of the, at least 20% of the greenhouse emissions from human sources. So, you know, I do think that there's something really potentially emancipatory about freeing ourselves from the grind of food preparation, food cultivation, and I think there's plenty of other activities that human beings would really enjoy doing instead of this.
You don't like cooking, do you, Buxar?
I actually do not, but that shouldn't undermine my argument here.
No. I'm just checking. I mean, I'm one who loves to cook.
Well, I do think that cooking is like a very important part, cooking and socializing.
Yes,
I like
right.
meals. I like sitting at the table and talking with my friends. And,
right.
And I think that's something that will never go away. I think it's something that we should really keep around as a leisure activity for the weekends or for, you know, maybe one meal a day. I think that what I envision Soylent doing is providing a cheap, nutritious alternative to the hot pocket meal. and I'm very skeptical. One should note that there's been a very little long-term studies on products like Soylent. So we don't know, for example, how much organic roughage we need in our intestines. We don't know the long-term health effects of using a liquid product like Soylent.
So I think, but in all seriousness, I mean, when I first read your piece, I thought I was trying to figure out if it was tongue in cheek, and I you know, or serious. But other than the fact that this is a way to kind of keep workers working harder, not getting in their breaks, not getting lunch breaks, because you can just drink your meal and keep on working, and people are already working longer hours and for less compensation in our society. But you're serious about that. This could resolve some of the issues that we face in terms of, in a different kind of society, face in terms of what's happening to the world's earth with raising animals and how we grow our food and the fact we have so many people and so much for the portion of the population are underfed. You are serious about that.
Well, I would add one caveat to that. I would say that the problems that we're facing are less technical in nature as are distributional and political. So we already have enough resources to feed everyone. We just have a social system that doesn't allow us to do so, that doesn't prioritize ending malnutrition or even simple things like malaria in the third world, the global south. But for me, this was extremely useful as a thought experiment to just think about how capitalism limits technology. And it makes us fear something like Soylent because it makes us realize that you know, even if we're spending, like I say in the article, even if we're spending most of our lunch breaks, you know, standing in line for some not very nutritious burrito at Chipotle, it's still much better than sitting in our cubicles like we do the rest of the day. That period of socializing with others and just having time away from the production process, from the grind, I think that's extremely important. Now, you can imagine a Soylent replacing that, or our biological need for lunch breaks being replaced as a result of us being able to just sit this at our desks throughout the mornings. I guess we'll still have bathroom breaks, but I'm sure they'll find a way to eliminate that next. But I do think that in a different context, you could imagine a society where Soylent's actually freeing humanity from a certain amount of necessary labor and allowing us to use that time elsewhere. Because most of our meals aren't spent like, you know, I myself, I'm Trinidadian, I'm of Indian descent, but I grew up in New York. So every Sunday I would go over to my my friend's house for a good Italian Sunday dinner, which would start somewhere around 3 p.m. and last until 9. And I think that's something that definitely shouldn't go away, those kind of meals and that kind of interaction. But I do think there's a certain freedom that we would get from being away from just the basics of food preparation, also food insecurity and whatnot that plague a lot of people. And I think Soylent's a step in the direction, if we have the political movements, to put this kind of thing under public ownership and also to produce the kind of scale that we need. So when I think about, I have a lot of friends who are involved in the urban farming and in other movements, and I very much support the impetus behind a lot of those right. Those efforts, but I do really question the problem of scale, and I don't want high quality food to be just something that a small minority has access to. So for me, there is some profoundly egalitarian implication of having one pouch for all men and women.
Well, Buck Sosankara, this has been really fascinating. I encourage people to go to Jacobin, J-A-C-O-B-I-N, of which he is the founding editor, for really thoughtful, provocative thinking. And Boxer, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites. It's been really interesting.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
Oh, honey, honey, you are my candy girl, and you got me wanting you.
We are about to have a conversation with Michael Moss, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His book, we're talking about Salt, Sugar, Fat. Welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Nice to talk to you again.
This book, when we did it last, I mean, it's an incredible piece of work. But what I want to start with, just give our listeners who didn't hear our previous conversation, before we hit each piece of this salt, sugar, and fat, is to talk about how you found out what you found out, how you found these documents that kind of unraveled and revealed a world to you that you almost didn't expect, that led you on this journey to find out why salt, sugar, fat so deep into our diets.
Absolutely. And for me, you know, Mark, this was like being inside a detective story, because so much of it was really surprising to me. I had one incredible stroke of luck, which is that when the state's attorney general sued Big Tobacco back in the 90s, they settled. And part of that settlement was the requirement that tobacco companies give up millions of pages of their documents, which are being archived and now are publicly available. Reporters have sort of lost interest. Nobody even looks at them anymore. But I discovered that within that trove of tobacco documents are these memos and letters and strategy papers and meeting minutes where the largest tobacco company of all, Philip Morris, was talking to its food division managers, the people at General Foods and Kraft, because what some of us have forgotten is that Philip Morris became the largest food manufacturer in North America starting back in the 80s when it acquired General Foods and Kraft. And so suddenly I was at the table of these and other of the largest food giants as they're formulating and planning and plotting their way to creating and marketing and selling new products. And it's that enabled me to identify and then talk their key people into talking to me and revealing even more secrets.
So, Michael, let's jump right into some of the more recent stuff that we've been talking about. And I've been following your work also in the Times a lot. But let's talk about Hot Pockets for a minute, talking about salt.
salt is, to the food industry, a miracle ingredient that does so many things for them. One, it acts as a preservative, right? So their products can last on the shelf for months at a time without deteriorating. Two, it's incredibly inexpensive at 10 cents a pound, and so it lets them avoid using fresh spices and herbs, and can use salt instead for what the industry calls the flavor burst. Salt is usually the first thing that touches your saliva when you eat something, and that sense that interacts with your taste receptors and sends that signal to the pleasure center of the brain that says, love it, eat more. And what surprised me is the extent to which salt acts as a savior to the food industry to mask, cover up some of the off notes, the bad flavors that are inherent to some processed foods. One of the toughest problems for them is meat, because when you rewarm meat, like in a product, like a frozen meat sandwich, like the Hot Pocket, or in a canned soup, the fat in the meat oxidizes and gives off what the industry calls warmed over flavor. Their chemists describe it as the taste of wet dog hair. And you guessed it, the solution to wet dog hair taste, warmed over flavor in processed foods is to add a little bit more salt. And so you'll find products, whether they're meat-based or not, like the Hot Pocket, which for a single package will have the maximum amount of sodium recommended for a majority of adults in an entire day. The amounts of salt in products are actually staggering. And I realized at one point that their dependence on salt is actually far greater than ours, because, you know, we're not born liking salt like we are sugar and fat. Liking for salt comes at about 6 months of age, and the Monell Center in Philadelphia, which in fact gets some of its money from the food industry, has done some research showing that the processed food industry is usually implicated in the development of cravings for salt. They looked at kids, divided them into half, and those who got regular sort of grocery store food starting at 6 months, which inherently is quite salty by and large, they were much more apt to be craving salt by the time they're in preschool, or even licking the salt shaker. And the flip side of that, too, is that any of your listeners who are older, who's been under doctor's order to cut back on sodium, knows that after about 6 weeks of time avoiding salty foods, you can hardly go shopping in the grocery store anymore because so many things taste over salty because you have adjusted your liking for salt downward. Well, as much as we can do that, avoid a salt craving in the first place and then get rid of it, the food companies are incredibly hooked on it.
Now, you had a piece, a wonderful little video I saw in the New York Times about salt, but its combination with fat. Was it about Cheetos?
Yeah, we recently did one on the Doritos.
Right.
You know, Doritos and Cheetos, these are engineered to what the food industry views as just the height of perfection in processed foods. They have so many incredible sort of elements in them. One of the most fabulous ones to them is this thing called sensory-specific satiety, which I like to call forgettability. When they balance all of the ingredients in those chips perfectly, and you eat one, you're left with kind of this memory of having eaten a really good thing, but you're not left with a memory of any one of the elements, whether it's salt or sugar or fat or the MSG or what have you. And that avoids tripping this part of the brain that puts a brake on overeating. And basically, if we get too much of one flavor, our brain says to us, hey, had enough of that, let's move on to something else. And by perfectly harmonizing the ingredients in their products, they avoid doing that, and so we're much more apt to eat more and more of them.
That part of it, reading that in the other parts of your book to describe that in various ways with various people in different industries. So, Michael, sugar. There's a great quote in your book, a big piece in your book about only sugar can do it all.
Yes, and also that the companies have been exploiting the biology of the child through their engineering and sort of manipulation, if you will, of sweetness in foods. I was lucky to spend time with a legend in the industry named Howard Moskowitz. He was trained in high math at Queens College, and then experimental psychology at Harvard. And he, you know, he has created many of the biggest icons in the grocery store for the food industry. He walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper, in which he started with no less than 61 different formulations of sweetness, each one just slightly different than the other, subjected those to 3,000-plus consumer taste testings around the country, then took the data, threw it in his computer, did his high math regression analysis thing, and out came a chart of what he has helped sort of coin the term the bliss point, which is basically the optimum amount of sweetness that would send most of us over the moon and the product flying off the shelf. And it looks like a bell-shaped curve, the kind of thing that kids would get, and they would dread sort of being at the top of the curve in the middle because that would be the middle C. But in this case, the top of the curve is the bliss point for sweetness, not too little and not too much sweetness. And what's really concerning to nutritionists and health policy people and public health agencies who are paying this $300 bill for obesity in North America is that companies have marched around the grocery store creating, engineering bliss points for foods that never really used to be sweet before. So that old bread now has sugar in it with an engineered bliss point. Low-fat yogurt can have as much sugar in it as ice cream. One of my favorites, prepared pasta sauces, some of the brands can have the equivalent of a couple of Oreo cookies in a tiny half-cup serving. And what this does, especially to kids who are so vulnerable to sugar, it teaches them to expect sweetness in everything they eat. So that when you drag the little rascals over to the produce aisle and get them to eat more vegetables, which everybody says we should be eating more of, you know, they're going to get hit by those bitter notes even harder than they otherwise would. If you know anybody who's ever read a diet book, I actually think that this book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, you know, once you know what the food companies are doing to you, the second you walk into the grocery store to try to compel you to buy their product, I actually find that goes far toward leveling the playing field. And that as a diet aid, it can work incredibly well, just kind of knowing everything that they're up to and trying to convince you.
I mean, I think that when we look at sugar, we're also not realizing that so much of this sugar is made up of high fructose corn syrup, which is why we see all these cornfields around us growing mounds and mounds of corn, and how that concentrated sugar is very different and a very different, does different things to our body than, let's say, the sugar we might get from the fields.
So I'm actually convinced by people I think are pretty smart on this that when it comes to calories, there really isn't much different among sugars. So sugar from sugar beets or sugar cane, sugar from field corn, sugar from fruit is all pretty much going to hit your body in the same way in terms of calories. One exception may be the very pure form of fructose, which you do see in some products now, generally at pretty low levels, but there is some research pointing and raising some alarms about fructose. But generally, from just a pure calorie standpoint, the general sense out there among experts is that sugar is sugar is sugar, and the industry plays a game where they'll move from fruit to corn syrup to table sugar, depending on which one we're more concerned about at any point in time.
We're going to take a very brief break here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly feature on the future of food in our food system. Stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Michael Moss. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm here with Michael Moss. We're talking about salt, sugar, fat, how the food giants hooked us. Let's go to the question of fat. And where did all this, you know, when you read the labels, talk a bit about the history of that and where all this fat crept into the food we eat popularly every day.
You know, fat was actually one of my favorite parts of the research for the book because in so many ways it's more powerful than even salt and sugar. You know, we don't actually taste fat scientists are still believing. It's not one of the basic tastes like sugar and bitter and
right.
saltiness. Rather, thanks to this thing called the trigeminal nerve, which comes down nearly to the roof of her mouth, fat creates a sensation that gets picked up by the brain. It goes right to the pleasure center of the brain, just like salt and sugar, and says, wow, love that, eat more. Fat is that sensation of biting into a warm, gooey, toasted cheese sandwich. You can tell I'm sort of a fat and salt guy myself.
I love grilled cheese sandwiches.
That my brain is going, wow, you know. When will people buy those, make those pledges so I can go, like, eat some potato chips? Get me off this phone. You know, and the industry has learned and worked with fat, so it became one of their most powerful additives. They call that sensation the mouthfeel of fat. Fat has twice the calories of sugar, but your brain is much less apt to detect it in food, especially when it's solid fat, which also happens to be the type of fat that's associated with heart disease, saturated fat. So ironically, we're much more apt to recognize fat in a product when it's oily, which typically will be saturated fat as opposed to hidden in there as fat. And I write about, you know, I spent a lot of time writing about the growth of cheese.
Cheese, that's a great part of the story.
You know, which basically is just, you know, a conveyance for fat. It is hugely loaded with saturated fat. Our consumption of cheese has tripled since the 70s, so to where we're now eating, on average per person, 33 pounds of cheese a year. 33 pounds. And I write about sort of how that happened, where the Department of Agriculture, in cahoots with the dairy industry, found a way to get us to eat more cheese, which was turning it into an additive. So now when you walk into the dairy aisle of the supermarket, and this is one of the things you want to know about as a consumer, it's loaded with packages of cheese that have been sliced, diced, shredded, stringed, tubbed, all to get us to put more cheese in our cooking at home. And then you walk through the store, and things like frozen pizza used to have a little cheese on the top.
Right.
Now it's got four or five cheeses on top and two more stuffed into the crust to maximize the allure, which also delivers those calories. Cheese is now the number one source of saturated fat in our diet.
So, and the in the few minutes we have left, two or three minutes here, a quick synopsis of James Lewis Kraft's first discoveries in cheese and how the decline in our dairy sales industry kind of pushed the sale of cheese.
Yes, so ironically, back in the 60s, people started drinking less whole milk as a way of avoiding saturated fat and calories. That left the dairy industry the problem because cows don't make low-fat milk, which is what people wanted to drink, and non-fat milk. So they had to make those things, they had to extract something called milk fat. Rather than throw that away, they started making more butter, more ice cream, and more cheese. They made so much cheese that the federal government started buying it because we have, for decades, wanted to support the dairy industry. None other than Ronald Reagan comes into office, discovers that there are caves filled with cheese going moldy that the federal government has bought because the dairy farmers are making so much cheese nobody can possibly eat it. They put their foot down. They say, no more buying of this cheese, but they create this scheme whereby the dairy farmers are allowed to tax themselves to create a marketing plan, and it's that marketing program using Madison Avenue that has gotten us to convert to eating cheese as an additive, something we don't even pay attention to in food, and it's there, and that's what drove the consumption of cheese.
Michael Moss, it's always a pleasure to have you on. You're just entertaining. You can go have your potato chips now.
Thank you so much.
We're about to talk with two river keepers. We all read about the oil spill that took place, the crude oil spill that took place in Jamestown, the Jamestown River, when a train car derailed, and it became huge news. The question now is, what has happened since? The headlines have gone, the fire has been put out, and what we know and don't know. Pat Calvert joins us. He's the Upper James River Keeper, and Jamie Brucknell joins us, who is the Lower James River Keeper. And Pat and Jamie, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
So let's talk a bit about where we are now. I mean, we've seen what happened then, which was this. This is like the third incident, by the way, that we've been watching from CSX. There was a coal derailment in Bowie, Maryland. There was the collapse of the road in Baltimore City on the rail line. And before that was this horrendous derailment and explosion of oil.
It was a rough 24 hours for CSX.
Yeah, it was. Rougher for the environment. Jamie, why don't you start? I mean, tell me what we know and don't know about what has happened since this oil spill.
Well, there's been a lot going on the ground since the spill happened last week. We've been sort of keeping in touch with all of those folks on the ground and doing our own assessments on the water and collecting some samples in the water. We know that the oil has largely flushed downstream from Lynchburg at this point. We're not really seeing chains or getting any more reports of those downstream to speak of. But Pat is actually, you know, he's based right there in Lynchburg. His office is 150 feet from where the derailment occurred. And he actually was able to discover just a couple days ago that there is oil present on the bottom of the river, right below the site there and extending a good ways downstream. So what we don't know is what is the true impact on the river at this point. We've heard some reports that we don't need to be worried about impacts to wildlife and to the environment. I don't think we can say that quite yet. We're trying to answer that question more concretely at this point. That's what we're really focusing our time on. One thing we have been worried about since this first occurred is that this period of time overlaps with spring migratory period for shad and river herring, and so that's a question that we still would like to get a better handle on. But Pat is the person that has been there since day one. We work in tandem. We are the James River Keepers, but I'm about 160 miles downstream right now, and so we've been working together remotely at times. I've been in Lynchburg for several days last week as well, and plan to get back up next week to do some more work.
So Pat, let me turn to you. And if you take us to where you are now, but do us a favor for us and for our listeners who may not have followed as intensely as some of us, talk a bit about what exactly happened in the beginning.
So at about 2:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th, there was a massive explosion. Like Jamie said, about 150 feet from our office. Fortunately, I was not at the office at that moment, but I rushed down to the scene. And the river was, there's some pretty startling video of the river that was ablaze. Nothing a riverkeeper really wants to see of their river, that's for certain. So immediately the concern was public safety at that point. And somehow, by the grace of something out there, no one was injured or killed by this massive explosion. It looks like at the latest I've seen is 25,000 gallons of crude Bakken oil, which is a light oil. It's extremely volatile, and it burned extremely quickly. As to how much burned and how much stayed in the river and has moved on, we're not certain. But I just received last night some photographs from someone, from a citizen downstream, who is also photographing sheen that was left behind. The river was really poor, really moving fast at the time of the explosion. Derailment. And so containing it was nearly not an option. There were several attempts by CSX contractors to set up booms miles and miles downstream to protect downstream drinking water sources. Because of the forest and because of large debris, trees coming down the river, a boom set across the top of the water to try to contain it, which you'd see around most oil spills or chemical spills, was just, they were all taken out and not successful for very long before the debris tore them down. So much of it, there was a sheen about 15 miles long that was reported to us from pilot. Jamie was with a volunteer pilot from a group on the South Wing, and the Shenandoah Riverkeeper provided staff to take photographs of the day after of where it was going, how fast it was going, to try to track its movement downstream, but it was swift. So now we're really in the trying to determine what should we monitor for, how should we monitor it, and how long, what kind of impact might result from this. To say that there are no impacts, I think, is premature at this time.
Yeah, because it's difficult to judge, as you, I think you're alluding to, what the effect of this is on the river and on the area around it. So I'm curious. I mean, this raises some larger issues just about the transfer of things like crude oil from the Bakken oil fields in the Dakotas through Virginia, was going up to Pennsylvania. That and that going through these residential areas, there was that explosion that took place in Quebec that killed all those people.
Certainly.
Right? And so, and we've seen other things occurring as well. So I was thinking about the chemical spill that just took place in 4 months back that took place in West Virginia, how it affected the drinking water. So what does it say to you all in terms of what we should be discussing and thinking about as a community at the moment? Jamie, you want to start? Then we'll go to Pat.
Sure. Jamie, go. Pat already alluded to this, but it's worth repeating. We really dodged a bullet with this accident. This could have gone so differently and had a much bigger impact. Only one car exploded, but it was fortunately we didn't have the terrible impacts. Nobody was hurt or killed. No buildings or the city didn't catch on fire. But I think the incident did do something for us and kind of raising some awareness here and pointing out a very big issue that we need to give some attention right away. And we've kind of hopped on that right away. Of course, we're trying to monitor the impacts from the explosion, but this is an incredible wake-up call that these are not the kinds of things we want going through our communities. And we have a huge growth going on right now with movement of Bakken oil, shale oil, which is more volatile, more dangerous. The regulations that exist right now have not caught up to the industry practices, where we have these large amounts of Bakken oil going to our communities. You know, the irony of all of this, too, is that we were told by a CSX contractor that the tank that ruptured and exploded was one of the recently upgraded tanks that was reinforced, designed to be able to handle more stress, I guess. So this is an incredible time that we need to act on. We've written a letter to our governor asking them to put a hold on these kinds of train movements for the time being until we really have an idea of the danger, the risk, and what we need to change within the regulations to make sure that this is being done in a safe way for both for people and for the environment.
Well, I'd like to add on. I'm specific.
Sure.
I mean, what is it? I mean,
well,
so
we don't
so
know. I mean, at the very basis of it, we don't know how much of this is going through our state or really nationally. People don't know how much of this is going through the communities, when, how frequently. And there were 105 cars, train cars. So far, we've only received confirmation that one of them exploded. You referred to the Lac Mégantic disaster in Quebec, and 47 people were killed in the middle of the night by that, one train car after another exploding. So while people can rest assured that, yeah, we dodged a bullet with this one, the threat is still there and alive, very much so. Emergency medical services are not really prepared to deal with this either if there is a spill, because they're not being made aware of when these are coming through. There's no transparency. So there needs to be clear transparency. There are groups forming, grassroots groups of train spotters that are basically just watching these trains go through and counting them and trying to determine what's inside them, because we really don't know. And as Jamie alluded to, these cars, the DOT-111, which is just the code for this particular kind of car, the latest U.S. Department of Transportation just came out yesterday with an order on these shipments of crude, Bakken crude. Unfortunately, it was a step in the right direction, but it only applies to trains carrying 35 cars or more of Bakken crude oil. It should probably apply to all forms of crude oil, and it should apply to anywhere from 1 to 1,000 cars. I believe any amount is significant, as we saw with this. That was one train car is confirmed to have actually spilled the oil that caused this explosion.
I'm curious if you find in your work on the James River what the communities around you are saying. I mean, are people, you know, it came and it went. You know, people can go to other things. So what is the sense of conversation, what people are talking about where you live now or around all this?
Yeah, well, in Lynchburg, I think, unfortunately, Lynchburg may have gotten a slight black eye for this. And I think people need to realize that this train track follows the James River for many, many miles upstream and downstream. It just happened to be in Lynchburg. It could have happened anywhere. And there are significant communities of densely populated areas where there are families and friends and neighbors working and living there. So Richmond could have easily been impacted. Major universities could have been impacted. Hospitals, schools. Yeah.
These trains are all, you know, destined for the Yorktown refinery, at least the one, you know, that went through Lynchburg was. And, you know, this is going through the Tidewater as well. So the James River stretches a long way. Like Pat said, the railroad generally follows the river all the way to Richmond until it branches off a little bit. But we even have trains going adjacent to William and Mary. Well-known university would be affected if something like this happened. Colonial Williamsburg. There are population centers that this would severely impact if we had another incident like this downstream.
So tell me what both your next steps will be. I mean, is are the river keepers going to do anything legally or just monitoring? What are your intentions now following this?
I'll say right now we the U.S. Department of Transportation sent out its memo on what it was planning to do. It's not strong enough at this point, in our opinion, but it is a step in the right direction. Senators Kane and Warner both came out asking for a quick, rapid response to this and to update our rails and people, especially emergency management staff, as to how to manage this and when to be prepared for them. I don't believe that the U.S. Department of Transportation's response is quite strong enough. I certainly appreciate it now, but we're going to have to continue to watch the ecological impacts and see what's going to arise, not just in the short term, but now we're looking at longer term of this, and we'll be asking for more stringent regulations regarding the transfer and also the storage of chemicals, like happened on the Elk River in West Virginia. Of all the chemicals in the state of Virginia that are stored, all toxic chemicals, 80%, more than 80% of them lie within the James River watershed, which is disturbing and alarming to us and our organization, our constituency. So we want to make certain that we don't have any more of these spills waiting to pop.
Well, I'm glad you took the time with us today, and I look forward to talking with you more. And then as these things develop, it would be good to get you into a conversation here with folks in Maryland who are facing the same thing and see where we all are.
Certainly. And I would say that people should check out, look at rails going through their communities and question what's on them. Take pictures if you like. Do a little bit of background research. Find out what's on those trains. There's a lot of literature out there right now.
And we should have the right to know.
Absolutely.
So I want to thank you both. Jamie Brunkow is Lower James River Keeper. Pat Calvert is the Upper James River Keeper. So we've been doing a follow-up on the oil spill that took place and what's going on now as we talk, as we always do, to our river keepers. Pat Calvert, Jamie Brunkow, thank you both so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mark.
Take care.
Bye.
Garlic, just let the pasta boil. Garlic, and add some olive oil and some oregano. Because we love it so.
So we're about to slide into another episode that we do here on Soundbites here, and that is our recipe. And we visited once with Kristen Carbone. She's owner of Radix Farms in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, talking about her land. We haven't gotten under to pay a visit, but we will. But right now she has a recipe with us. And Kristen, welcome. Good to have you back.
Great. Thanks. Nice to be back, Mark.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Just outside harvesting today in the beautiful, finally sunny weather.
That's good. What are you harvesting?
We did some cabbage, kale, arugula, and the last of my garlic scapes.
And there's the subject. So, so what is this garlic scape recipe you got?
Well, it is one of my most anticipated recipes of the year. I came across it about 7 years ago in Mother Earth News magazine. And ever since then, every time garlic scape season comes along, I'm so excited for it. It really highlights the scapes.
So, first of all, what is a garlic scape? Everybody knows.
It's the flowering shoot of the hardneck garlic plant. So in June, about a month before the garlic's ready, it sends up this flower stalk that if you leave will become a flower. But if you take it off, the plant will put more energy into growing a larger garlic head. So most farmers take them off, but they're also delicious and edible. The whole garlic plant's edible. It's why it's one of my favorite things to grow.
And I do love garlic. I do love garlic. Everything I cook has to have garlic in it. Most everything I cook has to have garlic
in it.
I mean, you can't cook without it. But this is different. So what do you do with this garlic scape? What is this recipe you do with it?
Well, you can do a lot with garlic scapes. This recipe, you really highlight the scape itself. Garlic scapes taste like garlic, but they don't overpower a dish like a garlic clove would. So with this one, first you cook a couple tablespoons of olive oil and a couple tablespoons of dark brown sugar until the sugar caramelizes in the oil. And then add the scapes, about half a pound of scapes, to your sauté pan. You sauté that for a few minutes with a cover on so they start to get nice and tender and caramelized. And then take that off and add a cup of chopped tomatoes, 3/4 cups of a dry white wine, salt and pepper to taste. And then you sauté that on low heat for another maybe 6 to 10 minutes until the scapes are nice and tender but not too soft.
And then
the final part that really pulls the dish together is you put grilled halloumi cheese on it, which is a...
Grilled what?
It's halloumi cheese. It's a goat or sheep cheese from Cyprus, but you can grill it and it doesn't melt.
So
on the grill pan separately, grill up the halloumi cheese and then add it to the dish. And it's a really salty, like really deep, flavorful cheese. And it really pulls it all together with the brown sugar and the white wine and the garlic. It's one of the most delicious dishes of the year. And then you take a nice fresh baguette and sit and eat your garlic scape seasonal dish.
It does sound good. So even if you're a healthy person, you're not afraid of a little brown sugar.
Right. No. It's not too much. Just enough to make it delicious.
That sounds really good. Now's the season, though, for garlic scapes. So if you want to make it, we got to go find our scapes now.
Definitely. I would say they're around for, about the month of June is the prime time to get them. You know, I sell them at the farmers markets, and a lot of local farmers do. And they store well. So I would suggest people stock up. They'll keep in your fridge for about a month.
Oh,
so
really?
Now's the time to get them. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many tons of farmers markets around all of us, whether it's in the Eastern Shore or here in Baltimore where we are. Most of the farmers have garlic scapes around.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Kristen Carbone and the farm is Radix Farms, which we'll be linking to on our website in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, in Prince George's County, where many of our listeners live, and worth tasting her food and checking out what they're doing there. And Kristen, once again, thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Mark.
Always good to talk to you.
Thank you. Bye.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Wright. To hear the show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.